From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. Good morning. I'm recording this on Monday, August 12, 2019. I've chosen three articles to discuss with you today. One of them looks at the relationship between ejection fraction and mortality in clinical practice. The second is a very interesting study looking at a meta-analysis of focused cardiac ultrasound versus clinical examination alone to identify LV dysfunction or valvular heart disease. And the third is a randomized trial looking at oral antihypertensive treatment in the management of severe hypertension in pregnancy from India. So let's start. The first study is a very interesting large analysis of the cohort of patients who had echocardiography in U.S. regional healthcare systems. There were over 400,000 echoes from over 200,000 individuals. And then a Cox proportional hazard model was created to assess where was the most favorable LVEF and at what levels did LVEF predict risk. The cohort analysis then was validated in a second cohort from New Zealand, comprising over 45,000 echoes in almost 36,000 patients. When the investigators did a very careful analysis, they ascertained a U-shaped relationship for LVEF and outcome. The lowest risk of mortality happened when the ejection fraction was 60 to 65%. If it was greater than 70%, there was a hazard ratio of increased risk of 1.71. And if the ejection fraction was 35 to 40%, there was a hazard ratio of 1.73. Interestingly, they observed this same relationship when they examined the relationship between EF and outcome in the validation cohort. So the authors concluded that an ideal ejection fraction for patients is 60 to 65%, regardless of age and taking into account sex and other comorbidities, including heart failure. And interestingly, they posited that a high ejection fraction is associated with higher risk. And it certainly calls to mind the question of whether or not we should have a fourth category of left ventricular phenotype, that is LVEF greater than 70 to 75%. And I think we've all seen some of these patients who have hypertrophic hearts, small ventricles, who can have very difficult to manage, presumably diastolic heart failure. And this is a study which sort of puts that group of patients into perspective, and maybe we will see that we will start to consider that fourth category of left ventricular ejection fraction. So this paper was published this past week in the European Heart Journal. Let's move now to the next article, which is a comparative accuracy study looking at focused cardiac ultrasound versus clinical examination for LV dysfunction and valvular heart disease, and it was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine this past week. So focused cardiac ultrasound, we'll call it FOCUS, was compared to clinical assessment alone in patients to look for the diagnosis of LV systolic dysfunction or valvular heart disease. This is a meta-analysis which looked at a number of studies that have been published. In all, there were nine that were representative, and only one of them was clinic-based. The other eight were hospital-based, and the median sample size in each of the studies was about 84 participants, the median age 64. Different types of professionals performed the focus examinations. Some cardiologists, some by intensivists, some cardiac sonographers, one study hospitalists, and three of them looked at medical students performing the studies after training. The sensitivity of clinical assessment for LV systolic dysfunction was 43%, whereas the use of focus increased that to 84%. The specificity of clinical assessment for LV systolic dysfunction was 81%, and with that of focus, it went up to 89%. For both aortic and mitral valve disease of at least moderate degree, clinical assessment alone was sensitivity of 46% compared to 71% for focus, and specificity was around 94% for both. The authors concluded from the meta-analysis that this focused ultrasound exam is more sensitive than clinical exam alone for LV systolic dysfunction and for both aortic and mitral valve disease of moderate or severe intensity, and that the specificities were relatively the same. I think the results of this are not particularly surprising. Obviously, we've all seen patients who have some degree of valve dysfunction and or LV dysfunction who are entirely asymptomatic and for whom the clinical examination is not revealing, where even a relatively brief ultrasound can identify that situation. One unanswered question, of course, is whether this would have any impact on clinical management. And since most of these patients were actually inpatients and they were getting full-blown echocardiogram, it's not clear exactly what the impact on management would be. However, if one were to flip that over and say, what about the value of focus examination in the clinic populations that we see? Well, then maybe that would be something that could be helpful. Also, what about the use of this particular tool in resource-poor settings where the access to full-blown imaging services are not there? So I think it's an interesting paper. Certainly is not a surprise to me that the use of even limited ultrasound can identify patients who have at least moderate degrees of LV dysfunction or valve dysfunction that are not easily identified by clinical assessment and physical examination. But where this will go in terms of its use in clinical practice remains to be seen. The last paper is an important article. It's a randomized trial of oral antihypertensive treatment for management of severe hypertension in pregnancy. And it's an open-label randomized trial from India. Two public hospitals in Nagpur, India, enrolled patients in this open-label randomized control trial. The inclusion criteria were pregnant women at gestational age of at least 28 weeks and severe hypertension. That's a systolic blood pressure greater than 160 or a diastolic greater than or equal to 110. And they were randomly assigned to 10 milligrams of nifedipine or 200 milligrams of labetalol or 1,000 milligrams of methildopa. The nifedipine and labetalol treatment groups received escalated hourly medications if the hypertension persists, but the methildopa group just had a single dose without escalation. And the primary outcome was control of blood pressure within 6 hours without an adverse outcome. And the goal was a systolic pressure in the 120 to 150 range and a diastolic from 70 to 100. It was a big study. They screened over 2,300 women and randomized about 900 of them and roughly divided equally to nifedipine, labetalol, and methildopa. The primary outcome goal, blood pressure within 6 hours, was achieved most frequently in women who received nifedipine. And that was higher than in the group receiving methildopa, 84% versus 76%, but not statistically meaningfully different from those getting labetalol, where the rate was 77%. There was no significant difference between nifedipine and labetalol. Adverse events in this study were very uncommon. One woman in labetalol treatment had an intrapartum seizure, and 6 neonates overall were stillborn, but no significant difference between the three cohorts. So the authors concluded that each of the three oral antihypertensive drugs lowered blood pressure adequately in most of the pregnant women, and nifedipine achieved the desired blood pressure more frequently than labetalol or methildopa. But all three are viable options and might be useful in a low-resource setting. Obviously, in a high-resource setting, we tend to use IV therapy, and often we use intravenous labetalol or hydralazine. But in resource-limited places, oral therapies have much more advantage, and each of these three appears to be fine. Nifedipine was more effective than methildopa, but interestingly, nifedipine is not specifically listed by the WHO as an oral medication for treatment of severe hypertension. In contrast, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology lists IV labetalol and hydralazine as first-line treatments, but also suggests that immediate-release oral nifedipine might be first-line, particularly when IV access is not available. Obviously, this is an important study. Nifedipine and labetalol both appear to be effective when given oral, and they can be escalated. The availability of randomized information in patients who are pregnant and hypertensive is so limited that this is really kind of a landmark study and one that I wanted to bring to you this week. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. We've talked about LVEF and outcome. We looked at focused ultrasound for the identification of LV dysfunction and valvular heart disease and discussed a randomized trial of different antihypertensive regimens for women in pregnancy who have severe hypertension. You can find our educational catalog feature on acc.org. This is under Education and Meetings tab. And using that tool, you can sort our educational offerings by various formats, and many of these, of course, are free. Hope you have a great week, and I'll talk to you again next week. Thank you.